From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we review the weekend nominating conventions. Now what for Michigan's Republicans and for Democrats?
For the past six presidential cycles, Michigan has gone blue. So for Democrats in a presidential year, it is all about turnout, getting folks to vote, and also down ballot.
We're tossing out 30% of our food. Battle Creek hopes to lead the way in solving America's food waste problem.
All of this waste could have gone to producing something more valuable or producing food that is actually eaten by people.
How racially charged violence across the nation can touch your child.
Even when you don't think children are exposed to racism, they may be. And it's our job to protect them as parents and caregivers.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan Republicans and Michigan Democrats held their summer nominating conventions over the weekend. Let's break them both down as we say hello to our It's Just Politics team of Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta. And let's start by doing a coin toss, shall we? Heads, Dems, tails, GOP. And it's tails. So Republicans first. Rick Pluta, what was the big takeaway from the meetings in Grand Rapids?
One is Rick Snyder, although not surprisingly, continues to balk at endorsing Donald Trump for president. And then two, that said that this Republican convention was not the internecine fight that we've seen in past ones.
Was that the dictionary.com word of the day?
But now there are, Zoe, are there not state GOP leaders that are very unhappy with the governor for standing on the sidelines with his hands up going, I'm not going to endorse Trump.
I mean, and this is what you're seeing nationally, right? I mean, it's you know, you could say it's a microcosm or whatnot. But I mean, this is what we're seeing, right? There are Republicans who are, you know, totally Trump, have been since the primary, believe that, you know, he is going to make America great again. And then you've got the Republicans that are either kind of holding their nose and saying, well, we've got to do it, you know, because he, you know, anything's better than Hillary is often what you hear some of these Republicans. And then you've got the Rick Snyders who are like, I'm not even jumping in. And we should note, you know, also is not bad mouthing Clinton either. So, yeah, you've got sure Republicans that are frustrating, you know, with the governor. And but we should note, too, that, you know, the governor is sort of the, I don't want to say his rival in the Republican Party, but, you know, another big, big Republican name, Bill Schuette, also.
I think we can call him his rival in the Republican Party.
Fair enough. That's
especially
for another
recent weeks.
Another. Right. No, exactly.
And Bill Schuette sort of, you know, crystallizes this, that beyond everything that Zoe just talked about, there is, in fact, a strategic divide within the Republican coalition as to whether or not the fortunes of the party rest on supporting Donald Trump and doing everything you can for the top of the ticket, you know, with the idea that that will also work for the rest of the Republican ticket, versus people who say, look, Trump is doomed and so are we if we don't find a way to distinguish ourselves from the top of the ticket. And so, you know, you're seeing that divide just among the strategic minds within the Republican Party.
I have to ask, we're going to pivot away from Trump for a minute and ask, can you explain, either one of you, how the Michigan Republican Party selected a delegate to the Electoral College who served nearly 4 years in federal prison for what has been called one of the worst accounting fraud scandals ever in 2003.
Yes, this is William Rawerdink, and he is a white-collar criminal. Went to prison, had to pay more than $250 million in restitution for his victims, and now he is a Republican.
And he was removed from the Republican State Central Committee when it was revealed that he was on it, and now the Republican Party. I mean, your question
Absolutely.
Was, can you explain it?
And
the answer is, I cannot.
No, I don't think either of us can. And here's what's, I mean, you know, I don't know if this is disingenuous or what, but a year ago when this was found out in 2015 by Chad Selesky, the Republicans were like, we didn't know. We can't believe this. I can assure you we're appalled. We had no idea. And then here we are, cut to a year later. And now what he got elected to be is a Republican Electoral College vote. So that means if Donald Trump wins, he will then go
wins
on
Michigan.
And be. Right. Yeah.
Yes.
he would then go on and put this vote. And he has now been active in the 14th congressional district. So, you know, this idea that this, I don't think either of Rick and I can explain this. It's unexplainable, at least for us. But then the addition is this idea that it was, you know, gasp, we can't believe this a
clutching
year ago.
Clutching pearls.
And now here he is
with,
being
I think,
elected.
Four posts. This the being named to the Electoral College was the fourth post he's gotten. Well, we're going to clutch our pearls, I guess.
Right, let's clutch pearls and keep on moving on, because I don't, you know.
let's move over to the Democrats. Zoe, what did you see as the big takeaway from the Democratic meeting?
Yeah, I mean, in what it, for the Democrats, it is all about in a presidential year is getting out the vote, right? And making sure that Democrats who are registered in Michigan, and the fact of the matter of business about it, as an old family friend used to say, is that there are more registered Democrats in Michigan than there are Republicans. For the past six presidential cycles, Michigan has gone blue. So for Democrats in a presidential year, it is all about turnout, getting folks to vote, and also down ballot. That the state house, nine seats Democrats want to turn in order to take control of the state house that they haven't since the big Republican wave in 2010. So that's where the focus was.
And is that doable, Rick Pluta, winning control?
Yeah, in fact, it's kind of interesting when, you know, we were just talking about, you know, this strategic diaspora within the Republican coalition, that the old saw used to be that Democrats have to fall in love, Republicans will fall in line. And we've seen that turned on its head in this cycle. That,
someone,
you know,
really
all
smart
the
must have said that before.
All of the, you know, the Bernie Sanders supporters who were never Hillary, who were vociferously opposed to Hillary Clinton, seem to be coming home to the Democratic coalition, that we're not seeing, a lot of the resentment that you might see after a hard-fought primary, one that Bernie Sanders actually won in Michigan, that the Sanders supporters saw a lot of things in the Democratic Party platform that they like. And, basically it looks like, if this convention is any evidence of it, that by and large, they are coming home.
Well, and look, we saw the same thing with Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton in 08, that there's a lot of, intra-party fighting up, in the primaries. And then it's just this all out war. And then it's suddenly just poof. I just a quick note, went to school in England for a little while, took some poli-sci classes there in high school. And they could not understand. They could not believe the idea that people of the same party, cats and dogs fighting, and then, it comes up and then everyone's back together in kumbaya. That's what we're seeing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think some people wanted, to think that's not what was going to happen. It is. And I don't think it's very unusual.
So everybody kind of got to vent at the Democratic National Convention. Yeah. The Bernie supporters got their chance, but now it's
tears
together.
Tears shed, and now it's hugs.
Now, we are coming down to the wire in the fight over whether that Republican pass ban on straight ticket voting is going to live to fight another day. Mm-hmm. It's been shot down in the courts. If we're allowed to split our tickets, Rick, what happens to those down ballot races?
I think that the most nervous person about that particular decision is John Austin. He is a Democrat and the president of the Michigan State Board of Education. And you might remember, in the last cycle, even though we by and large saw a Republican wave at the top of the ticket, that we saw a near Democratic sweep of the state university boards, Wayne State, Michigan State, U of M, and the State Board of Education. And a lot of people believe that is because of straight ticket voting, that people just went in, they marked their ballot for the Democrats, and whereas more Republicans just stopped voting somewhere around state representative, more votes got counted on that. So we'll see how that turns out. But if the ban is upheld, then the challenge for Democrats becomes convincing their base not just to get out, but to stick it out through the entire ballot. And that could be pretty lengthy in some cases.
Absolutely.
Our It's Just Politics team of Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta, as always, such a pleasure to have you on Stateside. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Cindy.
Glad to do it.
After 8 years, NPR recently ended its online comments, deciding it's more productive, more useful to disable the online comments at NPR.org and focus on conversations happening on social media. Well, Michigan Radio is going to do the same. We will discontinue the comment section of our website next Monday, September 5th. Here now to talk about this decision, what's behind it all, is Michigan Radio's digital editor, Mark Brosh. And Mark, certainly NPR and now Michigan Radio aren't outliers here, are we?
That's right. We have seen this before with other media organizations. Reuters has done it. New York Times has really pared down on what they allowed people to comment on. So it's been a trend that's been going on. NPR just kind of sparked the conversation for us.
And so we are going to do the same. And so what's going on here, Mark?
Yeah, so essentially this is kind of when you first – we first went online with digital news. Mm-hmm. Online commenting was kind of just a thing that you did. But we've discovered over the years – the conversations that tend to take place there just aren't very useful conversations. They tend to be conversations that, you know, people are sniping at each other, but there's no real value in that conversation that's taking place in that section of our website. And I think other people have found that as well.
And what have you found numbers-wise as far as is audience participation in the Michigan Radio online comment section?
It is a very small fraction of the people who come to our website and read the stories and take them in. In the last year, if you look at the numbers, we've had over 2 million unique users come to the website, read our news. But the number of comments that have been left, there's been 10,000 of them. So it's less than 1% of the total audience that's there. And frankly, I just don't think people go there to see the comments that often, not that big of an audience.
What do you say to those who say, hey, transparency, some transparency is going to be lost along with access to our producers and the reporters and hosts who deliver the news for Michigan Radio every day?
The transparency will not go away. We still have robust, lively conversations about the journalism we do on Facebook, on Twitter, through email, through phone calls. We have a lot of conversation going on there. So it's not going away. The conversation isn't going away. It's just that we're deciding that the conversation is not useful down in the comments section. It hasn't proven to be useful. If down the line there's some technology that comes out where
– new platform of
some
kind.
New platform where the conversation is useful, you know, we'll take a look at that. We're always kind of looking at ways to improve the conversation with the community. So transparency is always going to be there for us.
Do you feel like anything will be lost when comments, the online comments, end next Monday, Mark?
I don't think anything will be lost there. I really do think that we are going to have better conversations on the other channels that we have because we'll be able to dedicate more time to those other channels and spend more time in those places where the conversation is productive.
Mark Brush is Michigan Radio's digital editor. Thanks so much, Mark.
Thank you, Cindy.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The time is getting closer for launching special tax-free savings accounts for Michiganders with disabilities. It's called MyABLE, the Achieving a Better Life Experience Program, signed into law in Michigan late last year. And now we've learned the state has firmed up a contract with a Florida-based company to manage the savings program. David Bulkowski is with us now. He's Executive Director of Disability Advocates of Kent County. He's also a Kent County Commissioner. These new savings accounts, David, how much of a game changer are they for people with disabilities?
Well, at one level, they're a very significant game changer. The most important thing about these accounts is that people are starting to more openly discuss the wide needs and opportunities to meet those needs for people with disabilities as they age. And then as a particular tool, it is very good. Of course, the downside is it's a savings tool, so you have to have the money to be able to save.
Mm-hmm. But it lets people just, I guess, bottom line, I want to make sure I understand it. The ABLE program will let people with disabilities have special savings accounts so they could use those for disability-related expenses, but that doesn't hurt their eligibility for aid like SSI or Medicaid and other public benefits.
Absolutely, because that is one of the biggest downsides to government benefits is that if you're a saver, you know, and even a little bit of savings adds up over time, and you hit $2,500 of assets, you are now ineligible for those government benefits. And so this does allow you to build some wealth and to be able to supplement those government benefits either through your own savings or your family's savings, with deposits into your account. So you're absolutely correct in pointing out this helps immensely that it's basically a cliff. Mm. Once you hit that $2,501, you're ineligible.
So who's eligible to open one of these accounts? And also, what if they're unable to open the account themselves? How will that work?
Well, I mean, they will be able to, you know, work with themselves or work through the state's website to talk with the company that will be administering the program for the state to set up the account for their name. As the website points out, you know, you'll only be able to have the one account because there are limits on how much you can deposit each year. And they're, again, at least from my own family's perspective, you know, to deposit $14,000 a year, that's a high threshold. So for most families, they're not going to come near that limit of investment. And so, you know, people will, again, folks with disabilities or qualifying disabilities, and they're still working on those final definitions, will be able to access these accounts.
So this sounds like a change in viewpoint, that it's not saying you have to be in the most dire straits to be worthy of assistance.
You're absolutely correct in pointing that out. You know, it's pure dire straits. Again, we have such an either-or system when it comes to government benefits. Either you're eligible or you're not. And so this has some more kind of more of a ramp effect, and it does allow those dollars to be used for disability-related expenses, which is a very wide category. Because probably one of the best tools that exists today is a thing called a special needs trust. And nothing against attorneys, because I am one. However, you need an attorney pretty much to set up a special needs trust, and then you need a trustee. And then there, the biggest restriction is whatever is in the trust, it is for special needs. It can't be used for housing or clothing or food, because your government benefits are supposed to fund that. And so it's a higher and more burdensome thing to set up, and it's way more restrictive on what you can do with the proceeds. And so with these new 529 accounts, or the Michigan ABLE accounts, it will be a lot easier, again, for people to start one and then to use the proceeds to positively impact their lives.
And let's jump on that, David, and take the long view. What kind of a momentum do you hope will come out of these ABLE accounts?
Well, I hope, you know, again, that families will be able to use this, you know, and it, you know, it has the advantages of people can gift into these accounts, just like the 529 accounts, if people are, you know, using those vehicles to save for college. So there's that opportunity, and then those gifts, again, they can be straight up gifts. You don't have to worry about putting them in a special needs trust or trying to hide them, or it just makes it way easier. And then, hopefully, then the conversations we will start looking at things like in the area of SSDI. Right now, just the earnings potential within SSDI, if you choose to go back to work, it too has a cliff. Once you hit a level called significant gainful activity, you are then deemed ineligible. As opposed to in SSI, you lose a dollar of benefits for every $2 you make. So there is an incentive to go back to work. And again, the system will save some money by you going back to work, and you'll make money. So it's looking at some of those other systemic barriers that we have built in, where, again, our system was built when, I don't say most people, but the perspective was either you're eligible or you're not. And if you're eligible, that means you can't do anything else. So we as a community will help support you, as opposed to seeing, again, there are some folks that may not be able to work, but then there's a lot of folks that, you know, can work part-time or work up to full-time. And how are we helping to truly incentivize that path, as opposed to, you know, creating these barriers? And, of course, then people take care of themselves. You know, people will control these accounts and where the dollars go. And so it's, again, it continues to open that dialogue. How are we supporting our family, friends, and neighbors who are people with disabilities?
You can learn more about the Achieving a Better Life Experience program with details on applying by going to miable@michigan.gov. That's miable@michigan.gov. Thank you so much, David. David Belkowski, the Executive Director of Disability Advocates of Kent County.
You're very welcome.
Creation.
Curiosity.
The next idea.
We weren't setting out to do these huge things. We were just starting with solving a problem we hoped a few other people had.
You probably scraped food into the trash can today, or maybe you pitched an apple core out the car window. If you did that, you're contributing to America's food waste problem, and it's a big one, some $218 billion big. And now Battle Creek wants to be America's test laboratory and lead the way to zero food waste. Bill Schroer is with the Food Waste Solutions Committee in Battle Creek with us now. And Bill, we know the USDA has set a goal of cutting our nation's food waste in half by 2030. That's a pretty big lift. Why do you think Battle Creek is the perfect spot for a national test market laboratory to help figure out how to do that?
30% of the food we produce is wasted, which is just an astonishing number given the relative efficiency of the rest of our industrial system. As to why Battle Creek is the ideal place, there's a couple of reasons. First of all, Battle Creek is a food town dating back to the late 1800s when, of course, W.K. Kellogg initiated the Kellogg Company and then became the cereal capital of the world. We had 23 cereal companies here at one time. There's still Kellogg Post and ConAgra still have plants here, as well as the Kellogg Company has the WKKI Institute for Food Research. We have the International Food Protection Agency located here. We also have Covance Laboratories, which is a food packaging testing laboratory. We have, in addition, a large number of independent consultants who work for all of these food organizations who are food scientists or R&D or new product development people and so forth. For a town of 50,000 people, Battle Creek has a tremendous concentration of food assets and food resources that can be leveraged against really a number of food issues, but food waste is one of the things that we've identified. The other thing, and just because I'm an ex-food brand manager, and one of the things that you look for in a test market is that it's relatively small, relatively isolated, so it's not contaminated by other markets, and relatively reflective of the larger universe. And one of the things about Battle Creek is we have a major regional food bank, we have a number of food manufacturers, we have mass feeders, we have a large casino, and we have all of essentially the major component parts that in the food distribution and manufacturing cycle that contribute to the food waste problem. So in many ways, Battle Creek is uniquely structured and situated to be a test market for this issue.
Let's talk about this issue, Bill Schroer. Food waste, as you say, it's a big national problem, but let's take it down to day-to-day life. And the question would be, why is it such a big deal if I throw out something that I don't use in my refrigerator, I pitch something out the car window? Talk about what food waste really is.
One of the component parts of food waste that makes it so intractable or so difficult to deal with is that waste is generated pretty much at every step throughout the distribution system, both in manufacturing and distribution, and all the way down to the household level. As a matter of fact, in terms of the, you cited $218 billion in waste, of the $218 billion, $144 billion of that, or over 50%, is contributed by households. The household component part is actually one of the largest contributors to food waste, and that's unfortunate. It's done for a number of reasons. One is the fact that 40% of the food that's wasted is perishable food. In our country, perishable food is extremely cheap compared with costs of perishable food in other parts of the world. Fruits and vegetables, for example, make up most of the perishable food. So we throw it out, even necessarily before it's bad, but we just don't worry because it's so inexpensive. Another part of perishable foods are things that are freshness dated, milk, orange juice, yogurt, lots of things like that. Right now, as a country, we have no regulatory standards on freshness dating or best if used by. Huge problem. Essentially, what it's left to is the manufacturer to determine what that date should look like. Frankly, manufacturers don't have much of incentive to extend that date to the logical, useful life of the product.
Point taken. Toss it out and buy a new one.
Right. And, of course, people are concerned about safety. And if you don't know what the actual shelf life of a cup of yogurt is, you look at the freshness dating and you throw it out. The fact is it might be good for another 2 weeks, but you don't want to take that chance. The combination of perishables, the notion of freshness dating challenge, which is huge, the notion that because we as a country are looking for variety in our menu, we tend to buy a lot of things and then we don't necessarily use them and then we throw them out. The other thing is 55% of purchases in grocery stores are unplanned, which results in overpurchase and then spoilage. Mm-hmm. There's just a whole stream of issues at the home level.
So the idea that you and other committee members have written to the U.S. Agriculture Secretary with a proposal, set up a Food Waste Solutions Institute and a test laboratory in Battle Creek, what kind of solutions would you be looking at? What kind of research and testing do you envision?
Well, there's three fundamental categories of addressing food waste. One is in prevention, the second is recovery, and the third is in recycling. When it comes to prevention, there's a number of things that can be done at the manufacturing level. One of the contributing issues is the notion of line changeover. You know, that's kind of an inside baseball kind of thing.
Yeah, what does that mean?
The food business, of course, is frantic about cleanliness and sanitation and purity. When you stop running a food line, it stops. All of a sudden, you've got ingredients in the stream, in the pipeline. And so you have to then flush all of those ingredients, and they're all wasted. The fact they're perfectly good ingredients, wherever they are throughout the entire manufacturing line, have to be flushed in order to introduce new ingredients to run a different product. So if you're making yogurt, for example, or pizza, all of the particular flavors or component parts have to be flushed out of the system, and you introduce the new products. So helping manufacturers get better at running longer shifts of the same product would help reduce waste. Part of the problem, of course, is that in the marketing business, which I'm a marketing guy, one of the problems is that to get increased market share, you tend to move towards product segmentation. That is, more and more products that are marginally different in order to attract the next minute share of audience interest in a new flavor. So that leads to then more line changeovers because they have more products they have to keep up with. You know, that's a whole area right there.
Sure, sure.
Recovery oftentimes has to do with the notion of food donation. We have a major food bank here in the county, and even it ends up throwing away 1 million pounds of food a year. And
that's amazing, by the way. Our eyes all just went, our jaws hit the ground here.
Yeah. One of the things when you get into this issue, you recognize the scale is just astonishing. And it continues to blow my mind. But yeah, they have 1 million pounds of throwing away. And partly it's because of regulations regarding freshness dating. In other words, a food bank can't donate anything that goes past its expiration date, whether it's still perfectly good or not. So the expiration date issue has long tentacles that reach many, many ways. There's regulations also relating to what they can give away that's dented or if the packaging is torn. And of course, there's then the freshness issue of perishable fruits and vegetables. Big issue with donations, and this is something that's widely misunderstood, is the notion that we have mass feeders, that is, hotels, colleges, or restaurants, that in many cases have perfectly good food that they could donate to a homeless shelter or something of that nature, and they don't. And the reason they don't is because they're afraid of litigation. They're afraid to be sued if someone gets sick.
Talking about this proposed Food Waste Solutions Institute, you did write a letter to the secretary of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and that was on June 20th.
Right.
And have you had any kind of response?
I have not.
It was actually, it wasn't just a letter. I'm looking at it. It was a very, very detailed proposal. So yes. You've broken down. Here's what it would cost to do this. Here's who we are. And a work plan. You've got a whole timeline, so it's all there.
We've had a remarkable partnership. The Battle Creek Community Foundation has underwritten this. We've had some real expertise. The city is on board, and the city has a very, very real interest in this because they've been prevented from incinerating their solid waste.
Have you considered or have you reached out to any of Michigan's representatives on Capitol Hill to try to push this forward?
We wanted to provide an appropriate amount of time for this proposal to work its way through the system before, you know, kind
start of rattling other cages.
Before, exactly. You said that, so thank you for being so direct.
Okay. Bill, what's at stake if we don't wrap our arms around the food waste problem in Michigan and in this country?
You know, the amount of waste extends beyond the food itself. There's a huge amount of loss of productivity in man hours. There's a huge loss in the waste of water. Water is one of the biggest ingredients to producing fruits and vegetables. The water tonnage that is essentially wasted for the food that then is not used, the amount of land that's basically being wasted, the amount of food waste we have in this country to grow that amount of food would take 3/4 of the state of California. That's how much land is being essentially wasted or inappropriately used. And all of these are finite resources. The amount of water we have is finite. The amount of land we have is finite. You know, there's an opportunity cost here. In economics, the opportunity cost is all of this waste could have gone to producing something more valuable or producing food that is actually eaten by people. I mean, it's incredible that we have hungry people in this country when we're throwing away 30% of our food.
Bill Schroer is with the Food Waste Solutions Committee in Battle Creek. Bill, it was great to talk with you. Thank you so very much. You'll have to let us know if you ever hear back from Secretary Vilsack.
I certainly will, Cynthia. And thank you again for the opportunity to talk about this. It's been great fun.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. These days, most rock and roll radio stations play a limited number of songs and play those songs over and over and over again. That's because audience research has gotten so high-tech, stations believe they know exactly what songs attract the most listeners. Our story today is about the owners of a radio station in Grayling. They say classic rock is worn out. They've launched a counteroffensive, and they're breaking all the rules about how to run a radio station in the 21st century. Peter Payette has the story.
Q100 is in the woods, at the end of a dirt drive, just outside Grayling. Inside, the walls are full of old posters of rock stars like the Beatles and Janis Joplin. There's one that promotes a Ted Nugent concert in Detroit in 1970. There's a lounge with lava lamps and tapestries on the ceiling.
All of this has been donated by fans that just come up and say, "We love what you're doing. Look what I have. Can you display it? Would you like it?" Isn't that amazing? And there's more, as you'll see, coming through.
That's Cheryl Coyne. She and her husband Jerry bought the station 4 years ago. Before that, Cheryl had a career in sales in commercial radio in Detroit. Jerry never worked in radio until they invested their life savings here. Now he's the afternoon DJ, Monday through Friday.
Howdy, howdy, ho! There's the Clash and White Riot here on Q100 as we get kicked off on a beautiful Thursday afternoon.
Jerry Coyne is tall, 6'7". His hair is clean cut, and he's wearing a pink and black golf shirt. He was a teenager back in the 1970s and saw bands like Led Zeppelin and the Rolling Stones in concert. He says being a DJ reminds him of his college days, when he'd drive around with his friends, pop a tape in, and see how they'd react.
You know how much we've liked the Stripes and played their first album quite a bit. At the end of last year, they released album number 2, and this song is just fabulous. This is A Good Night's Sleep and A Cab Fare Home on Q100, saving rock and roll one listener at a time. Now, here, listen to this song. I guarantee you've never heard this song, and it's great. And I get phone calls about it all the time. These are four kids from outside of Dublin that the oldest guy in the band is 18. Are you dynamite with the chance, or are you just keeping grip for a sip of my
GNC? Well, I'm well past good, I'm ready, but I'm too well on to keep... This approach to music programming is almost unheard of in commercial radio these days. Usually surveys determine what DJs play. But on Q100, Jerry fills 4 hours every afternoon, and he says half his show will be filled with listener requests.
Q100. Yeah. Yeah, who's that? I know, what, you mean Neil Young's Crazy Horse? Well, I know a song that Neil Young does with Pearl Jam called Downtown. Are you talking to, is this a different song? All right, I'll see if I can dig it up. Thanks.
Jerry says calls like this come in all the time.
And I'm like, wow, I can't believe I never heard that song or I forgot to put that song on the playlist.
The playlist is the list of songs a radio station plays. And here's what's really unconventional about this station. The playlist has more than 6,700 songs on it. Most stations in the U.S. play a tenth of that. Joe Lund is a consultant who works with stations around the country. He says one of the first things he does is encourage them to play fewer songs.
That's one of the fastest ways to grow time spent listening, is find out what people want to hear. And that is do music research and then specialize in just those songs. And that usually means cutting the playlist.
In big markets, the way they find out what people want to hear is with a device called a personal people meter. It's about the size of a cell phone. It hangs around the listener's neck and keeps track of what radio stations they're hearing.
And with PPM, the ratings are so precise, you get minute-by-minute ratings. And you can look at a radio station's programming, and you can see how people are listening and tuning away and coming in and going out.
People tune in and out a lot. and they don't listen for very long. So the thinking is, figure out what songs they like best, and then just play those songs. And that way, when listeners do tune in, there's a better chance they'll hear something they like. And if they hear something they like, they'll keep listening. And program directors don't screw around, because in major radio markets, a slight dip in the number of people listening can mean hundreds of thousands of dollars in lost advertising revenue. So the risk with Q100's approach is that someone will turn on the station and hear a song they don't recognize, and then change the station. But Jerry Coyne says radio stations driven by ratings are boring, and he says it's especially shameful for rock stations.
Rock and roll was revolutionary. I mean, it stopped the Vietnam War. We had Woodstock. I mean, it was a huge portion of the culture, changing the entire culture. And now it's just this corporate, it's become what everything, what it always rebelled about is what it became. How screwed up is that? So that's why we came up with, you know, Saving Rock and Roll One Listener at a Time. We're going to fight the fight one song at a time. Isn't that cool? What's cooler than that? All right, that's REM and Bang and Blame here on Q100. One of their greatest songs by far and away. I love the whole lyrical story.
The Coynes have a business strategy. Build a loyal audience. And what they mean by loyal is people who turn their station on and leave it on, even through the commercials, because they like the station. Jerry's wife Cheryl says if they focused on ratings, they'd cater to listeners who are loyal to certain songs. But those songs can be found other places. So when a commercial comes on, listeners like that push a button and are gone.
Because they want to hear a song. They don't want to hear the commercial. And if you keep pushing buttons, the advertising message isn't coming through. And if the advertising message doesn't come through, the results aren't there and the advertiser won't come back.
Something's working, because when they bought this station 4 years ago, one guy worked here. Now the rock revolution in Grayling employs 12 people full-time, plus the Coynes, who work more than full-time. Jerry Coyne says when they started out, he had no confidence that this approach would work. But he says it makes sense that it does.
See, ultimately, we're in the entertainment business, and content matters. You know, I've got 50 years of people writing and performing great music, so if you play that, people are going to pay attention. That's what it boils down to.
And there's another simple way to look at it. Jerry says they started a radio station that they would enjoy. And it appears a lot of other people do, too. For Stateside, I'm Peter Payette.
This story originally aired on The Green Room, Interlochen Public Radio's weekly show on arts and culture in northern Michigan. You can find it on their airwaves every Friday, and the podcast is on iTunes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. Whenever there's a story of racially charged violence that consumes the news cycle, parents have a challenge. How much do you tell your child? How do you answer your child's questions? Do you wade right into what happened and why? Or do you divert them, try to give them something different to think about? For parents of color, these challenges come up every time there's an act of police-related violence on black males or violence aimed at police officers just doing their jobs, such as we saw in Dallas or Baton Rouge. Dr. Nia Hurd-Garris is a pediatrician and the Robert Wood Johnson Clinical Scholar at the University of Michigan School of Medicine. She's doing research on the impact that racism and these racially charged news stories can have on children. Pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
It is worth starting our conversation by noticing right out of the gate, you are a pediatrician, but you're a mom, and your son was born in 2012, right about the time Trayvon Martin was killed.
Yes.
That has to inform you in a way that you can't even describe.
Totally. Thank you for asking me that, because even today, just I'm shaking thinking about that. At a time where I was pregnant and I should have been ecstatic, mm-hmm. I was fearful. I was so scared to bring a black male into the world because I felt like the world wasn't really ready for him. And then after the deaths of Philando Castile and Alton Sterling, those feelings resurfaced, and I couldn't believe I was in that place again. Mm. It didn't matter how educated I was. It took me back there, and I was scared.
And you're very concerned about the effects of vicarious racism on young people like your son, other young people. What is that and why is it so worrisome?
That's a great question, because vicarious racism is racism experienced through the eyes of someone else. So someone else experiencing the racism directly can still be transmitted to other people, even if they're not in that close proximity. So it's feeling those effects, even though you yourself weren't directly discriminated against. And that's why it's so problematic, because even if a kid is in Kansas and sees those events on the news, that could still affect him or her. And that's why I'm so worried.
What kind of effects?
It can cause post-traumatic stress disorder or acute stress disorder. So kids being fearful to go outside, to take out the trash, because they think they'll be next, or not able to sleep or eat or continue in their daily lives as we know it. And that's why that's so insidious, because it's not them directly, but they're still having the same traumatic effects as if it were.
And there really has not been much research done to really look at the impact that racism and these police shootings are having on children, and that's something you want to do. Tell us what your goal is going to be with the research you're going to do.
Exactly. The biggest parallels we can draw is to what we've seen at 9/11.
Yes.
There were a lot of studies done after 9/11 looking at that very thing. We learned that children and some mothers that weren't directly exposed to the events of 9/11 were still having those stress reactions. And that is important, because trauma finds its way into our minds and our bodies, and we need to find ways to help children recover from those. So for me, it's important to study that. In my research, I want to know more about how those events can affect children and their caregivers, and more importantly, what can we do to reduce and prevent any negative impact? And my wish is that none of us have to be exposed to racism. Well, none of us live in a society that racism is prevalent. But in the meantime, we need to figure out ways to help our children recover from those negative events.
And when you think of young minds that are just sponges at that point, I think I'm hearing you say what they experience and feel now, let's say as a 5 or 6 year old, they may not realize when they're 46 and they have, you know, ways of behaving and reacting that it comes dates back to this.
Right. And let me tell you, so I've never had any bad experiences with the police at all. But when I shortly after I moved to Ann Arbor, I was in the car with someone who was driving really fast and got pulled over. And I was just in the passenger seat. And as soon as the police officer pulled me over, I started shaking. I was like, oh, my gosh, this could be the last day that I live. And for me, who's never had a bad experience with the police, very well educated, lives in a nice neighborhood, it didn't matter. At that moment, I was scared. And so I think that's why it's important for us to be talking about this today.
It's almost like head versus heart
at
war here. It is truly amazing what kids absorb from the world around them. Can you tell us how your son gave you a special window into what parents might be facing?
Yes, thank you. I was walking with my son down the street. It was actually the day that my article was published.
In theconversation.com.
In theconversation.com. And we were walking together, and we saw a baby bird on the ground. And the baby bird was dead. And my son said, Mommy, what happened to the baby bird? And in a clumsy way, I tried to explain to a 3.5-year-old the circle of life and how the baby bird died. And, you know, I wasn't doing that great of a job of it, but I was trying. But then he asked me, did the police kill it? And I was taken aback. It really surprised me, because even though I'm thinking about this issue so much and researching it, we don't expose him. My husband and I try really hard to not talk about that in front of him, to not let him watch any TV or media at all about that. But he was still exposed somehow. So what I really want your listeners to know is that even when you don't think children are exposed to racism, they may be. And it's our job to protect them as parents and caregivers.
And as you say, you try to shield your little one from TV. But for the kids out there, when you think of TV and social media, it has really impacted this issue in a way that perhaps wasn't as prevalent when I know when I was growing up. There was no social media. We didn't have cable television.
Exactly.
News was on for a half an hour after dinner.
Exactly. So for kids my son's age, 3.5-year-olds, they should not be seeing TV at all about this. You really should try hard to protect them. But you're absolutely right. The older kids that are acutely aware of what's going on, who are watching the news, you need to sit right there with them so that as they're seeing those images and hearing the stories, you can help them process it right then and there. Social media is more difficult, because through social media, these stories can live on forever, even months and years after these things are happened. They're tweeted and retweeted and shared and liked and commented on. So I would say to check back in, you know, frequently with your child and say, hey, are other kids at school talking about this? What are your friends saying? So that you're able to keep your finger on what's happening and what your child is experiencing.
Now, do you bring these conversations into your practice as a pediatrician?
Yes, I really try. And honestly, parents ask me, how do I talk to my kid about this? It's just kind of like other uncomfortable topics. How do you do that? And how do you broach that conversation? So if I'm concerned that, you know, a parent is not really addressing those issues that the kid is facing, I'll say, hey, have you talked to your child about that? Or what do you think? How have you broached that topic? And so that usually creates a conversation. But generally, parents will ask me.
Now, I'm interested. You're clearly having these conversations with parents of color.
Yeah.
What about white parents?
Yeah, that is a fantastic question. And I can't say for all parents
sure.
what those conversations should be. But I think exposure on any level, no matter where you live, no matter what you look like, no matter how old you are, kids are getting those experiences. So I think whether you're a parent of a white child or a parent of a child of color, those conversations still need to happen. So I would say, you know, as a pediatrician myself, I say, you know, we need to be talking about this. It's uncomfortable. It's not going to make us feel great doing it, but it's so important.
What do you hope will come ultimately out of the kind of research you're going to do, looking at the effects of racism on youngsters?
Well, there are four key things that I want parents to walk away from this yeah. article, from this news piece, from my research. And the four things really are to seek the mental health care that they may need because they may personally be affected by it. And you can't help your kids until you help yourself. So being supportive to your friends and colleagues that may be going through this too, mm-hmm. they're having a tough time processing it, making sure they go and get the mental health care that they need. But two, also, again, talking to our kids and making sure we know what they know and we can dispel the rumors and alleviate some of those heightened fears. We need to be on the pulse of what's happening with our children. And the third thing is if our children are having disruptive things in their lives, such as these events, we need to talk to our pediatricians, our primary care providers, our mental health providers to help us. We can't do it alone. Mm-hmm. We need to share this with our medical providers so that they know what's going on too. And the last thing is to limit the exposure as much as we possibly can. I know it's so hard, but we have got to try to do it.
I know we heard people say it after 9/11, turn off the TV.
Exactly.
Over and over when you'd see the planes hit the towers.
Exactly.
Your three-year-old doesn't realize that that's a tape replay.
Right. Exactly. They think it's happening again and again.
Great advice. Dr. Nia Hurd-Garris, pediatrician and the Robert Wood Johnson Clinical Scholar at the University of Michigan School of Medicine. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Stateside producers are Ellie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, and Lindsay Scullin. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.